Peter shook his head. Heard what? We've separated. Oh, said Peter, I'm sorry. I hadn't realized how many of our friends were really just her friends, said Colin. The server arrived, set down little napkins, deposited the drinks on them, then scurried away. I'm glad you agreed to come to lunch. No problem, said Peter. He had never been good at this kind of social situation. Was he supposed to ask Colin what had gone wrong? Peter rarely spoke of private matters, and, on the whole, didn't like either asking or answering personal questions. I'm sorry to hear about you two. His cliché dispenser suggested, adding, You always seemed so happy, but he stopped himself before the thought was given voice. Peter's own recent experience had taught him to put no stock in appearances. We'd been having problems for quite some time, said Colin. Peter squeezed his lime into his Diet Coke. We weren't really on the same wavelength anymore. Apparently Colin had a cliché dispenser of his own. We weren't talking. You just drifted apart, said Peter, not quite making it a question, not wanting to pry. Yeah, said Colin. He took a liberal swig of his drink, then winced as if it were a masochistic pleasure. Yeah. You'd been together a long time, said Peter, again, careful to keep his tone flat, to keep the statement from becoming a question. 11 years, if you count the time we lived together before we got married, said Colin. He cupped his glass in both hands. Peter wondered idly who had broken up with whom. None of my business, he thought. A good long time, he said. I was seeing someone else, said Colin, a woman in Montreal. I had to go there every 3 weeks on business. Took the maglev out. Peter was dumbfounded. Was everyone screwing outside of marriage these days? Oh, he said. It didn't really mean anything, said Colin, making a dismissive gesture with his hand. It was just, you know, just a way of getting a message to Naomi. He looked up. A cry for help, maybe, you know? No, thought Peter. No, I don't. Just a cry for help, but she went crazy when I told her, said that was the last straw, the straw that broke the camel's back. Clearly, thought Peter, everyone had a cliché dispenser. I didn't want to hurt her, but I had needs, you know. I don't think she should have left me over something like that. The server came in again, depositing Peter's club sandwich and Colin's pasta primavera. What do you think? Asked Colin. I think you're an asshole, Peter thought. I think you're the biggest fucking asshole on the planet. Hard luck, he said, pulling the toothpick out of one of his sandwich wedges and spreading mayonnaise on the turkey. Hard luck, indeed. Anyway, said Colin, perhaps sensing that it was time to change the subject, I didn't ask you to lunch to talk about me. I really wanted to get some advice from you. Peter looked at him. Oh? Well, you and Kathy were at that Life Unlimited seminar. What did you think?
Impressive sales pitch, said Peter.
I mean, what did you think of the process? You're a biomedical engineer. Do you think it would really work?
Peter shrugged.
Jay Leno says Queen Elizabeth has undergone the process. Only way to save the monarchy was to make sure that none of her children ever got to sit on the throne.
Colin chuckled politely, but looked at Peter as if he expected a more serious response. Peter chewed on a bit of his sandwich. Then,
I don't know. The basic premise seems sound. I mean, there are, what, 5 basic models for senescence and eventual death? Peter ticked them off on his fingers. First, there's the stochastic theory. It says our bodies are complex machines, and like all complex machines, something's bound to break down eventually. Second, the hayflick phenomenon. Human cells seem to only be able to divide about 50 times total. Third, the smudged Xerox hypothesis. Small errors are introduced every time DNA is copied, and at some point the copy gets so bad that it doesn't make sense anymore. Boom, you're pushing up daisies. And number 4 is the toxic waste theory. Something, possibly free radicals, gives your body trouble from the inside. And finally, the autoimmune hypothesis, in which your body's natural defenses become confused and turn upon your own healthy cells.
Colin nodded. And no one knows which one is right. "Oh, I suspect they're all right to one degree or another," said Peter. "But the key thing is that Life Unlimiteds, what did they call them, nannies, their nannies seem to address all five probable causes, so yes, I'd say it's got a good chance of working. There's no way to know for sure, though, until someone who has undergone the process actually does live for a few centuries." So you think it'd be worth the money?" said Colin. Peter shrugged again. "On the surface, yeah, I guess so. I mean, who wouldn't want to live forever? But then again, it'd be a shame to do that if it meant missing out on a wonderful heaven." Colin cocked his head. "You're sounding downright religious, Peter." Peter concentrated on finishing his food. "Sorry, idle thoughts, that's all. What did Kathy think of Life Unlimited?"
"She didn't seem very interested," said Peter.
"Really?" said Colin. "I think it sounds great. I think it's something I'd very much like to do."
"Costs a fortune," said Peter. "You've been embezzling from the bank?"
"Hardly," said Colin. "But I think it would be worth every penny."
It took 3 weeks to get 2 additional recordings of the soul wave departing from human bodies. Peter made one of the recordings at Carlson's Chronic Care, the same place he'd met Peggy Fennell. This time the subject was Gustav Reichholdt, a man just a few years older than Peter who was dying of complications from AIDS and had chosen to end his life through doctor-assisted suicide. The other recording, though, had to be made somewhere else, lest critics charge that the soul wave, far from being a universal component of human existence, was simply some mundane electrical phenomenon related to the wiring in that particular building, or to its proximity to power lines, or to some particular course of treatment used at Carlson's. So, to get his 3rd recording, Peter had put an ad out on the net. Wanted: person in very late stages of terminal illness or injury to participate in testing a new biomedical monitoring device. Location, Southern Ontario. Will pay participant CAD 10,000, terminal individuals, or persons with power of attorney for same. Please apply in confidence to Hobson Monitoring. Net Hobmon. Peter felt funny about placing the ad. It seemed so cold. Indeed, his embarrassment probably had a lot to do with why he offered such a large fee. But within 2 days of the ad going out on the net, Peter had 14 applicants. He chose a boy just 12 years of age who was dying of leukemia. He made the choice as much for compassionate reasons as for varying the sample base. The boy's family had bankrupted themselves, coming to Canada from Uganda in hopes of finding a cure for their son. The money would be some small help in paying their hospital bills. And feeling, upon reflection, that the others who had already participated in the study deserved the same compensation, Peter also made a $10,000 payment to the estate of Gustav Reichholdt. Since Peggy Fennell had no heirs, he made a donation in her name to the Canadian Diabetes Association. He reasoned that soon researchers around the globe would be scrambling to reproduce his results. It seemed appropriate to establish up front a generous payment for test subjects. All 3 recordings looked remarkably similar. A tiny cohesive electrical field departing the body at the precise moment of death. To be on the safe side, Peter had used a different super EEG unit to record the Ugandan boy's death. The principles were the same, but he used all new components, some employing different engineering solutions, to make sure that the previous results weren't due to some glitch in his recording equipment. Meanwhile, over the course of several weeks, Peter had also used a super EEG on all 119 employees of Hobson Monitoring, without telling any, except his most senior staff, what it was actually for. None of his employees were dying, of course, but Peter wanted to be sure that the soul wave did indeed exist in healthy people, and wasn't just some sort of electrical last gasp produced by an expiring brain. The soul wave had a distinctive electrical signature. The frequency was very high, well above that of normal electrochemical brain activity, so even though the voltage was minuscule, it wasn't washed out in the mass of other signals within the brain. After making some refinements to his equipment, Peter had little trouble isolating it in scans of all his employees' brains, although he did find it amusing that it took several tries to locate it in the brain of Caleb Martin, his staff lawyer.
Meanwhile, that selfsame Martin had been working his tail off securing patent protection on all the super EEG components in Canada, the United States, the European Community, Japan, the CIS, and elsewhere. And the Korean manufacturing firm Hobson Monitoring used to actually build its equipment was gearing up a new production line for super EEGs. Soon, it would be time to go public with the existence of the Soul Wave. Chapter 12. Peter felt like a student again, pulling off a silly fraternity prank involving putting clothing on animals. He made his way over to one of the cows and stroked it gently at the base of the neck. It had been years since Peter had been this close to a cow. He'd grown up in Regina but still had relatives who owned dairy farms elsewhere in Saskatchewan, and he'd spent parts of his boyhood summers there. Like all cows, this one had enormous brown eyes and wet nostrils. It seemed unperturbed by Peter touching it, and so, without further ado, he gently strapped the modified scanning helmet onto its loaf-shaped head. The beast mooed at him, but more in apparent surprise than protest. Its breath stank.
"That it, Doc?" asked the foreperson.
Peter looked at the animal again. He felt a little sorry for it.
"Yes."
At this slaughterhouse, cattle were normally stunned with an electrical charge before being killed, but that method would overload Peter's scanner, so instead this particular cow would be rendered unconscious with carbon dioxide gas, hung, and then have its throat slit for drainage. Peter had seen a lot of surgery over the years, but that cutting had always been to cure. He was surprised at how upsetting he found the killing of the animal. The foreperson invited him to stay for a full tour, including the butchering of a cow, but Peter didn't have the stomach for it. He simply retrieved the special bovine headgear and his recording equipment, thanked the various people he'd inconvenienced, and headed back to his office. Peter spent the rest of the day going over the recording, trying various computer enhancement techniques on the data. The results were always the same. No matter what method he used, or how hard he looked, he could find no evidence that cows had souls. Nothing of any kind seemed to exit the brain at death. Not too surprising a revelation, he supposed, although he was quickly coming to realize that for every person who would hail him as a genius for his discoveries, there'd be another who would damn him for them. In this case, the radical animal rights lobby would surely be upset. Peter and Kathy had been planning to go to Barbarians, their favorite steakhouse, for dinner that night. At the last minute, though, Peter canceled their reservation, and they went to a vegetarian restaurant instead. When Peter Hobson had taken a university elective in taxonomy, the two species of chimpanzees had been pan troglodytes, common chimps, and pan paniscus, pygmy chimps. But the split between chimps and humans had occurred just 500,000 generations ago, and they still have 98.4% of their DNA in common. In 1993, a group including evolutionist Richard Dawkins and best-selling science fiction writer Douglas Adams published the Declaration on Great Apes, which urged the adoption of a Bill of Rights for our simian cousins. It took 13 years, but eventually their declaration came to be argued at the UN. An unprecedented resolution was adopted, formally reclassifying chimpanzees as members of genus Homo, meaning there were now 3 extant species of humanity, Homo sapiens, Homo troglodytes, and Homo paniscus. Human rights were divided into 2 broad categories, those such as the entitlement to life, liberty, and freedom from torture, that applied to all members of genus Homo, and other rights such as pursuit of happiness, religious freedom, and ownership of land that were reserved exclusively to H. sapiens. Of course, under Homo rights, no one could ever kill a chimp again for experimental purposes. Indeed, no one could imprison a chimp in a lab, and many nations had modified their legal definitions of homicide to include the killing of chimps. Adrian Cortlandt, the first animal behaviorist to observe wild chimpanzees, once referred to them as eerie souls in animals' furs. But now Peter Hobson was in a position to see how literally Cortlandt's observation should be taken. The soul wave existed in Homo sapiens. It did not exist in Bos taurus, the common cow. Peter supported the simian rights movement, but all the good that had been done in the last few years might be undone if it were shown that humans had souls but chimps did not. Still, Peter knew that if he himself did not do the test, Someone else eventually would. Even though chimps were no longer captured for labs, zoos, or circuses, some were still living in human-operated facilities. The United Kingdom, Canada, the U.S., Tanzania, and Burundi jointly funded a chimpanzee retirement home in Glasgow, of all places, for chimps that couldn't be returned to the wild. Peter phoned the sanctuary to find out if any of the chimps there were near death. According to the director, Brenda McTavish, several were in their 50s, which was old age for a chimp, but none were terminal. Still, Peter arranged to have some scanning equipment shipped to her. "And so," Peter said to Sarkar during their weekly dinner at Sonny Gottlieb's, "I think I'm ready to go public now. Oh, and my marketing people have come up with a name for the super EEG. They're calling it a soul detector." "Oh, please," said Sarkar. Peter grinned. "Hey, I always leave those decisions up to Joginder and his people. Anyway, the soul detector patents are in place. We've got a backlog of almost 200 units ready for shipment. I've got 3 good recordings of the soul wave leaving human beings. I know that at least some animals don't have souls, and I'll hopefully soon have the data on chimps as well." Sarkar spread lox on a bagel half. "You're still missing one important piece of information." "Oh? I'm surprised you haven't thought of the question yourself, Peter." "What question?" "The flip side of your original inquiry. You know now when the soul leaves the body, but when does the soul arrive?" Peter's jaw went slack.
You mean
in a fetus?"
"Precisely."
"Holy shit," said Peter. "I could get in a lot of trouble asking that question."
"Perhaps," said Sarkar. "But as soon as you go public, someone will ask it."
"The controversy will be incredible." Sarkar nodded.
"Indeed. But I'm surprised it hadn't occurred to you."
Peter looked away. He'd been suppressing it, no doubt. An old wound long since healed, or so he'd thought.
Damn, thought Peter. God damn.
Chapter 13. It had happened 13 years ago, during their first year of marriage. Peter remembered it all vividly. October the 31st, 1998. Even back then they didn't eat at home often, but they'd always thought it rude to go out on Halloween. Someone should be in to give treats to the kids. Kathy made fettuccine Alfredo while Peter put together a Caesar salad with real bacon bits crisped in the microwave, and they collaborated on making a cake for dessert. They had fun cooking together, and the tight confines of the tiny kitchen they'd had back then made for plenty of enjoyable contact as they squeezed past each other, jockeying for access to the kitchen's various cupboards and appliances. Kathy had ended up with flour stains in the shapes of Peter's handprints on each of her breasts, while Peter had her handprints on his bum. But after they'd finished eating the salads and had made a good start on the pasta, Kathy had said without preamble, "I'm pregnant." Peter had to put his fork down and look at her.
"Really?"
"Yes.
That's..." He knew you should say "that's wonderful," but he was unable to get the second word out. Instead, he settled for "interesting." She chilled visibly.
"Interesting? Well, I mean, it's unexpected, that's all." A pause.
"Weren't you..."
Another pause.
"Damn.
I think it was that weekend at my parents' cottage," she said. "Remember, you'd forgotten to—"
"I remember," said Peter, a slight edge in his voice.
"You said you'd have a vasectomy when you turned 30," Kathy said, a tad defensively. "You said if by then we still didn't want to have kids, you'd do it."
"Well, I wasn't bloody well going to do it on my birthday. I'm still 30, and besides, we were still discussing whether to have a child."
"Then why are you angry?" asked Kathy.
"I'm not," he smiled.
"Really, darling, I'm not. It's just a surprise, that's all."
He paused. "So, if it was that weekend, you're, what, 6 weeks along?"
She nodded. "I missed my period, so I bought one of those kits."
"I see," said Peter.
"You don't want the baby," she said.
"I didn't say that. I don't know what I want."
At that point, the doorbell rang. Peter got up to answer it. Trick or treat, he thought. Trick or treat. Peter and Kathy had waited another 3 weeks, weighing their options, their lifestyle, their dreams. Finally, though, they made their decision. The abortion clinic on College Street had been in an old two-story brownstone. On its left had been a greasy spoon called Joe's, no apostrophe, that advertised a breakfast special with two eggs any way you like them. On its right had been an appliance store with a hand-lettered sign in the window that said, "We do repairs." And in front of the clinic there had been protesters marching up and down the sidewalk carrying placards. "Abortion is murder," said one. "Sinner repent," said another. "Babies have rights too," said a third, perhaps produced by Joe's sign-maker. A bored-looking police officer was leaning against the brownstone's wall, making sure the protesters didn't get out of hand. Peter and Kathy parked across the street and got out of their car. Kathy looked toward the clinic and shivered even though it wasn't particularly cold. "I didn't think there would be that many protesters," she said. Peter counted eight of them, 3 men and 5 women. "There are always going to be some," she nodded. Peter moved next to her and took her hand. She squeezed it and managed a slight brave smile. They waited for a break in the traffic, then crossed. As soon as they arrived at the other side, the protester closed in on them.
"Don't go in there, lady," shouted one. "It's your baby," shouted another. "Take some time," shouted a third. "Think it over."
The cop moved close enough to see that the protesters weren't actually touching Kathy or preventing her from gaining access. Kathy kept her eyes facing straight ahead. "Eggs any way you like," thought Peter. "Repairs done here."
"Don't do it, lady," shouted one of the protesters again. "It's your baby. Take some time. Think it over."
There were 4 stone steps leading up to the wooden doors of the clinic. She started up them, Peter right behind.
"It's... don't... take..."
Peter stepped ahead to open the door for Kathy. They went inside. Peter had had his vasectomy the following week. He and Kathy never spoke again of that episode from their past, but sometimes when her sister's daughters were visiting, or when they ran into a neighbor taking a baby for a stroll, or when they saw children on TV, Peter would find himself feeling wistful and sad and confused, and he would steal a look at his wife and see in her large blue eyes the same mix of emotions and uncertainty. And now they had to face that moral issue all over again. There was no way to put a scanning skull cap on a fetus, of course, but Peter didn't need to scan all electrical activity in the unborn child's brain. All he needed was equipment to detect the high-frequency soul wave. It took him days of work, but he eventually managed to cobble together a scanner that could be laid on a pregnant woman's belly to detect the soul wave inside. The unit incorporated some of the scanning at a distance technology from the Hobson monitor and employed a directional sensor to make sure the mother's own soul wave wasn't mistakenly picked up. The soul wave was exceedingly faint, and the fetus was deep within the woman's body. So, just like a telescope taking prolonged exposures to build up an image, Peter suspected this sensor would probably have to be in place for about 4 hours before a determination could be made of whether the soul wave was present. Peter went down to his company's finance department. One of the senior analysts there, Victoria Kallipides, was just beginning her 9th month of pregnancy. "Victoria," Peter said, "I need your help." She looked up expectantly. Peter smiled at the thought. Everything she did these days was expectantly. "I've got a new prototype sensor I'd like you to help me test," he said. Victoria looked surprised. "Does it have to do with my baby?" "That's right. It's just a sensor web that's laid over your belly. It won't hurt you, and it can't harm the baby in any way. It's, well, it's like an EEG. It detects activity in the fetal brain. And there's no way it can hurt the baby." Peter shook his head. "None." "I don't know. Please." Peter surprised himself with the forcefulness with which he said the word. Victoria considered. "All right. When do you need me?" "Right now? I've got lots of work to do today, and you know what my boss is like. Placing the sensor will only take a few minutes because the signals are so faint you'll have to wear it for the rest of the afternoon, but you'll be able to go on with your work." Victoria got to her feet, no easy task this late in her pregnancy, and went with Peter to a private room. "I'm going to describe to you how the sensor should be placed," said Peter. "Then I'll leave you alone and let you put it on yourself. It should fit under your clothes without difficulty." Victoria listened to Peter's instructions, then nodded. "Thank you," said Peter as he left her to undress. "Thank you very much." At the end of the day, he had the results. The sensor had had no trouble detecting the soul wave coming from Victoria's fetus. Not too surprising. Had the baby been removed at this late point in the pregnancy, it would probably have survived on its own. But how soon into a pregnancy did the soul wave first appear? Peter flipped through his computerized Rolodex until he found the number he wanted. Dinah Kawasaki, a woman he had taken some courses with at U of T, who now had an obstetrics practice in Don Mills. He listened nervously to the electronic tones as the computer dialed the number. If Dinah could convince some of her patients to help him, he'd soon have his answer. And Peter realized he was afraid of what that answer might be.
Chapter 14, October 2011. 32 of Dinah Kawasaki's expectant patients did agree to participate in testing Peter's scanning equipment. That wasn't surprising. Peter had offered a fee of $500 per patient simply for wearing the scanner for 4 hours. Each patient was 1 week farther along in her pregnancy than the one before. Peter would eventually want to do studies throughout their individual terms on multiple women, but the initial results were clear. The soul wave arrived sometime between the 9th and 10th week of pregnancy. Before that, it simply didn't exist. He'd need much finer studies to show whether it arose from within the fetal brain or, less likely, Peter thought, somehow arrived from outside. Peter knew that this would change the world almost as much as the realization that some form of life after death actually existed. Some would still quibble with the interpretation, but Peter could now say categorically whether or not a given fetus was a person, whether or not its removal would be simply sucking out an unwanted growth or an act of murder. The implications would be profound. Why, if the Pope could be convinced that the soul wave really was the physical signature of the immortal being, and that the soul only appeared 10 weeks into pregnancy, perhaps he'd remove his restriction on birth control and on early abortion. Peter remembered that back in 1993, the then-Pope had originally told women who had been raped by soldiers in Bosnia-Herzegovina that they would be damned unless they brought their babies to term. And the current Pope still refused to allow birth control in famine-torn areas, even when babies would starve to death once born. Of course, the women's movement, of which Peter considered himself a supporter, would react too. Peter had always had a hard time with abortion, especially in industrialized countries. Perfectly reliable, unobtrusive methods of birth control existed. Peter had always accepted intellectually that a woman had the right to an abortion on demand, but he'd found the whole issue distasteful. Surely unwanted conception was something best avoided in the first place. Surely birth control by both partners in a relationship wasn't too much to ask. Why cheapen the wonder of reproduction? It had taken all of 10 minutes on the net to dig up the statistic that 1 in 5 pregnancies in North America ended in abortion, and yet, of course, he and Kathy had conceived all those years ago without planning to. Him a Ph.D., her with a degree in chemistry. 2 people who should have known better. Nothing is ever as simple in the concrete as it is in the abstract. But now perhaps there was justification for after-conception birth control. The soul, whatever the soul might be, arrived only after 60 or more days of gestation. Peter was no futurist, but he could see where society would go. Within a decade, laws would doubtless change to allowing abortion on demand up until the arrival of the soul wave. Once the soul wave was present in the fetus, the court would rule that the unborn child was in fact a human being. Peter had wanted answers, cold hard facts, and now he had them. He took a deep breath. He was a rationalist. He knew that there had always been only 3 possible answers to the moral question raised by abortion. 1, a child is a human being from the moment of conception. That had always seemed silly to Peter. At conception, a child is nothing but a single cell. 2, a child becomes a human being the moment it exits from the mother's body. That had seemed equally silly. Although a fetus draws nutrition from the mother until the umbilical cord is severed, the fetus is developed enough to support itself, if need be, weeks before the normal end of a pregnancy. Clearly the cutting of the cord is as arbitrary as the cutting of the ribbon to open a new mole. The fetus is a human being with an independent heart and brain, and thoughts, prior to emerging into the world. So all Peter had done was prove what should have been intuitively obvious. Option 3, somewhere between the two extremes, between conception and birth. A fetus becomes a human being in its own right, and with its own rights. That option 3 turned out to be correct should have been expected. Even many religions held that the arrival of the soul occurred sometime in the middle of pregnancy. St. Thomas Aquinas had allowed abortion to the 6th week for male fetuses and the 3rd month for females, those being the points at which he believed the soul entered the body. And in Muslim belief, according to Sarkar, the nafs entered the fetus on the 40th day after conception. Granted, none of those coincided with Peter's figure of 9 or 10 weeks, but the certain knowledge that there was a specific point at which the soul did arrive would, the thought occurred to him again, would change the world. And, of course, not everyone would think it a change for the better. Peter wondered what it would be like to see himself burned in effigy on TV. It had been just over 9 weeks since Kathy had told Peter about her affair. Things had remained strained between them throughout that period, but now it was necessary that they have a serious talk. A talk about a different crisis. A crisis from their past. Today was Monday, October the 10th, Canadian Thanksgiving. Both of them had the day off. Peter came into the living room. Kathy was sitting on the love seat during the New York Times crossword. Peter came over and sat next to her. "Kathy," he said, "there's something I have to say." Kathy's enormous eyes met his, and suddenly Peter realized what she was thinking. He'd made his decision, she thought. He was leaving her. He saw in her face all the fear, all the sadness, all the courage. She was struggling for composure. "It's about our baby," said Peter. Kathy's face changed abruptly. She was confused now. "What baby?" Peter swallowed hard. "The baby we, aborted 12 years ago. Kathy's eyes were moving back and forth. She clearly didn't understand. "Next week my company will be making a public announcement about the soul wave," he said. "At that time some additional research will be revealed, but I wanted you to hear about it first." Kathy was silent. "I know now when the soul wave arrives in a child." She read his manner, read his hesitancy. She knew his every gesture, his whole body language, vocabulary. "Oh, God," Kathy said, her eyes wide in horror. "It arrives early, doesn't it? Prior to when we... Peter said nothing. "Oh, God," she said again, shaking her head. "It was the '90s," she said, as if that summed it all up. "The '90s." Back then, the abortion issue, like most others, had been simplified to a ridiculous sloganeering level. Pro-choice, as if there were another faction that was anti-choice. Pro-life, as if there had been a group that was against life. No grays were allowed. In the Hobson's circle, educated, well-off, liberal, Eastern Canada, pro-choice had been the only stance to take. The '90s. The politically correct '90s. Peter shook his head. "It's not clear," he said. "We did it right around the time the soul wave would have first appeared." He paused, not knowing what to say. "It might have been okay. Or it might have been... Peter nodded. "I'm so sorry, Kathy." She chewed her lower lip, confused and sad. Peter reached out and touched her hand. Chapter 15. Hobson Monitoring had a standard database of medical journalists worldwide to whom electronic press kits were routinely sent. A few members of Peter's senior staff argued that this particular release should also go to religion editors, but Peter vetoed that. He was still uncomfortable with the moral aspects of the discovery. Besides, everyone from the National Enquirer on down would be clamoring for interviews soon enough. An invitation to the press conference went out by email and courier 3 days in advance of the actual event. Peter was uneasy about the wording of the invitation, but Joginder Singh, his PR person, was adamant that this was the correct approach. Hobson Monitoring Limited invites you to attend a press conference on Thursday, October the 20th at 10 a.m. in Room 104 of the Metro Toronto Convention Center. We will be unveiling a fundamental breakthrough in science. Sorry, folks, no hints until you get there. But we promise that this story will be front-page news around the globe. Video link-ups are available for those unable to attend in person. Contact Joe Ginder at Hobson Monitoring for details. Several reporters did call, trying to sniff out whether the story would really be worth pursuing, or if this was just going to be the release of a new piece of hospital gadgetry, but no advance information was given out. Everyone had to wait until Thursday morning. And then? About 40 reporters showed up for the press conference. Hobson Monitoring had only once before gotten more, back when it had announced its first public share offering. Peter knew half the reporters by name. Buck Pikers, medical correspondent for the Toronto Star, Corey Tick, his counterpart from the Globe and Mail, Leanne Delaney from CBC News World, a fat guy who covered Canadian stories for the Buffalo News, a stringer for USA Today, and many more. The reporters helped themselves to fresh fruit and coffee while they chatted amongst themselves. They were surprised to not be receiving press kits up front, although Peter and Joginder assured them that full kits, including data disks and transcripts of Peter's remarks, would be distributed as they exited. Several of the journalists present would videotape the conference anyway. Kathy had taken a vacation day to be there with Peter. At a quarter after 10, he made his way up to the front of the room. Kathy beamed at him, and despite the butterflies in his stomach, he drew strength from her presence. "Hello, everyone," he said, smiling at them all in turn, but holding a special, lingering smile on Kathy. "Thank you for coming out. Please forgive all the secrecy. I know it seems a tad melodramatic, but what we're going to announce here today is something very special, and we wanted to be sure that responsible journalists heard about it first." He smiled. "Joginder, if you'll dim the lights, please. Thanks. Now, everyone, please watch the wall monitor. You'll all be getting copies of the recording I'm about to play when you leave. All set? Run the demo, please, Joginder." The journalists watched intently as Peter narrated a slowed-down playback of the brain scans of Peggy Fennell's death. Peter went into a fair bit of technical detail. These were, after all, medical correspondents. When the soul wave actually departed from Mrs. Fennell's head, a murmur moved through the audience. "Play that last bit again," called out Parkers from the Star. Peter signaled Joginder to do so. "Exactly what is that?" asked another reporter. Peter looked at Kathy sitting in the front row. Her eyes were twinkling. He affected a shrug. "It's a cohesive electrical field that leaves the body through the temple at the moment of death." "At the exact moment of death?" asked Delaney, the woman from Newsworld. "Yes, it's the final bit of electrical activity in the brain." So it's what?" said the woman. "Some kind of a soul?" She said the word offhandedly, as if a joke, giving her room to retreat in case she was making a fool of herself. But in the week since Sarker had first uttered that term, Peter had grown more comfortable with it. "Yes," he said, "that's exactly what we think it is." He raised his voice, speaking generally to the room. "There it is, ladies and gentlemen, the first ever direct scientific recording of what may be a human soul leaving a body." A buzz erupted, everyone talking at once. Peter spent the next 2 hours answering questions, although some of the print reporters with early deadlines grabbed the press kits and exited almost at once. He made clear that his studies had yet to reveal exactly what happened to the soul wave after departure. It seemed to remain coherent, but there was still no proof that it didn't dissipate shortly after leaving the body. He also stressed that very little data was available yet about the content or structure of the soul wave, and in particular about what, if any, meaningful information it contained. But it made no difference. The idea of a soul was an archetype universally grasped. People already were sure in their hearts of what the soul wave represented. That night, Kathy and Peter saw that the CBC TV story was picked up by CNN in the States and the BBC World Service. The announcement was all over the net within hours and made front-page news in the evening editions of the Toronto Star and several American papers, and was plastered across page one of newspapers around the world the next day. Within 24 hours, the entire developed world knew about the discovery. Suddenly, Peter Hobson was a celebrity.
"Is the caller still there?" asked Donahue, back on daytime TV after his failed presidential bid. "I'm here, Phil."
Donahue made his tortured face. Precious seconds were being wasted.
"Go ahead, I have very little time."
"What I'd like to know," said the caller's voice, "is what life after death is really like. I mean, we know now that it exists, but what's it really like?"
Donahue turned to Peter.
"That's a very good question, caller. Dr. Hobson, what is the afterlife like?"
Peter shifted in his chair.
"Well, that's more a subject for philosophers, I'm afraid, and—"
Donahue turned toward the studio audience.
"Audience, are we prepared for these questions? Do we really want to know the answers? And what will America do if the afterlife turns out to be unpleasant?"
He spoke into the air.
"Show 'em, Brian. Number 14.
A chart appeared on the screen.
67% of the people of this good country, said Donahue, believe that the soul wave proves the Judeo-Christian model of a heaven and a hell. Only 11% believe that your discovery, Dr. Hobson, disproves that model.
The chart disappeared. Donahue spied a raised hand in the back of the studio. Still spry at 75, he bolted for the back row and shoved a microphone under a woman's chin.
Yes, ma'am, you had a brief comment.
That's right, Phil. I'm from Memphis. We love your show down there.
First the little boy face patted on the head.
Thank you, ma'am.
Then the pained face, as if something was caught going down his gullet.
I have very little time.
My question is for the doctor. Do you think your discovery is going to get you into heaven, or are you going to hell for interfering in God's mysteries?
Close up on Peter.
I have no idea.
Donahue did his standard theatrical arm gesture that ended with his finger pointing directly into the camera. And we'll be back.
The silver-haired Latin fox turned to face the audience. According to the tabloids, he'd recently undergone the Life Unlimited process, so viewers had centuries of his particular brand of television to look forward to.
"Life after life," he said portentously. "That's our focus on this edition of Geraldo. Our guests today include Peter Hobson, the Ottawa scientist, who claims to have captured the immortal soul on film, and Monsignor Carlos Latina of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles."
Geraldo turned to the man wearing a black cassock.
"Monsignor, where do you think the souls are today of those clergy members who molested boys in church-run orphanages?"
Roll computer graphic of Capitol Building Dome. Cue music. Announcer.
From ABC News, this week with Peter Jennings. Now from our Washington headquarters, here's Peter Jennings.
Jennings, gray-haired, doer, facing into the camera.
The soul wave, fact or fantasy? Religious revelation or scientific truth? We'll ask our guests, Peter Hobson, the engineer who first detected the soul wave, Carl Sagan, author of the best-selling Eyes of Creation, and Helen Johannes, presidential advisor on religion in America. Some background on all this from our man, Kyle Adair. And joining me in our Washington studio will be...
Medium shot of Donaldson, his features sharp despite his wrinkles, his shoe-polished brown toupee looking obviously fake.
Sam Donaldson.
Medium shot of silver-haired Will, wall-eyed and bow-tied, looking like a retired plantation owner.
And George Will. Later, we'll be joined by commentator Sally Fernandez of the Washington Post, all here on our Sunday program.
Run commercials. Archer Daniels Midland's new all-vegetable automobile. General Dynamics. Our work may be classified, but we're a good corporate citizen. Merrill Lynch, because someday the economy will turn around. Roll pre-recorded backgrounder. Fade up in studio. Jennings.
Kyle, thank you.
Recap guests and panelists. Insert Peter Hobson on wall monitor with Dateline display atop showing Toronto. Sam Donaldson leaning forward.
Professor Hobson, your discovery of the soul wave could be seen as a great liberator of oppressed people. Final proof that all men and women are created equal. What effect do you think your discovery will have on totalitarian regimes?
Hobson politely. Excuse me, but I'm not a professor.
Donaldson. I stand corrected, but don't duck my question, sir. What effect will your discoveries have on the human rights violations going on in the eastern Ukraine?
Hobson, after a moment's reflection.
Well, I'd love to think that I've struck a blow for human equality, of course, but it seems that our ability to be inhuman has survived every challenge to it in the past.
George Will over steepled fingers.
Dr. Hobson, the average American, struggling under the burden of an excessive government with a ravenous appetite for tax dollars, cares not one whit about the geopolitical ramifications of your research. The average church-going American wants to know, in precise and plain language, sir, exactly what characteristics the afterlife actually has.
Hobson, blinking. Is that a question?
Will. It is the question, Dr. Hobson.
Hobson, shaking head slowly.
I have no idea.
Chapter 16. Peter wasn't about to let his newfound celebrity interfere with his Tuesday evening dinners with Sarker at Sonny Gottlieb's. But he did have something very specific that he wanted to explore with Sarker, and he began without preamble. How do you create an artificial intelligence? You work in that field. How do you do it?
Sarker looked surprised. Well, there are many ways. The oldest is the interview method. If we wanted a system to do financial planning, we would ask questions of several financial planners. Then we reduce the answers as a series of rules that can be expressed in computer code. If A and B are true, do C.
But what about that scanner my company built for you? Aren't you doing full brain dumps of specific people now?
We are making good progress toward that. We've got a prototype called Rick Green, but we're not ready to go public with it. You know that comedian, Rick Green?
Sure.
We did a full scan of him. The resulting system can now tell jokes that are just as funny as the ones the real Rick tells. And by giving it access to the Canadian press and UPI news feeds, it can even generate new topical humor.
Okay, so you can essentially clone in silicon a specific human mind.
Get with the 21st century, Peter. We use gallium arsenide, not silicon.
Whatever.
But you have hit upon what makes the problem crisp. We are just at the point where we can clone one specific human mind. A shame that such a technique did not exist in time to scan Stephen Hawking. But there are very few applications in which you want the knowledge of just one person. For most expert systems, you really want the combined knowledge of many practitioners. So far, there is no way to combine, say, Rick Green and Jerry Seinfeld, or to build a combined Stephen Hawking Mordecai Almy neural net. Although I had high hopes for this technology, I suspect most of the contracts we'll get will be for duplicating the brains of autocratic company presidents who think their heirs are going to be interested in what they have to say after they're dead.
Peter nodded.
Besides, said Sarker, total brain dumps are turning out to be a tremendous waste of resources. When we created Rick Green, all we were really interested in was his sense of humor. But the system also gives us everything else Rick knows, including his approaches to raising his children, an endless amount of expertise about model trains, which are his hobby, and even his cooking technique, something no one in his right mind would want to emulate.
Can't you pare it down to isolate just the sense of humor?
That's difficult. We're getting good at decoding what each neural net does, but there are many interconnections. When we tried deleting the part about child-rearing, we found the system no longer made jokes about family life.
But you can make an accurate duplicate of a specific human mind on a computer.
It's a brand new technique, Peter, but so far, yes, the duplication seems accurate.
And you can at least to some extent decode the functions of the various neural interconnections?
Yes, said Sarker. Again, we've only tried it on the Rick Green prototype, and that was a limited model.
And once you've identified a function, you can delete it from the overall brain simulacrum?
Bearing in mind that deleting one thing may change the way something that seems unrelated will respond, yes, I'd say we're at the point at which we can do that.
All right, said Peter. Let me propose an experiment. Say we make two copies of a specific person's mind. In one of them you excise everything related to the physical body, hormonal responses, sexual urges, things like that, and in the second one you remove everything related to bodily degeneration, to fear of old age and dying, and so on.
Sarker ate a matzo ball.
And what would the point be? The first one would be to answer that question everyone keeps asking me, what is life after death really like? What parts of the human psyche could persist separate from the body? And while we're at it, I figure we'd do the second one, a simulation of a being who knew he was physically immortal, like someone who has undergone that life unlimited process. Sarkar stopped chewing. His mouth hung open, giving an undignified view of a masticated dumpling. That's incredible, he said at last around his food. Subhanallah, what an idea! Could you do it? Sarkar swallowed. Maybe, he said. Electronic eschatology, what a concept! You'd need to make the two brain dumps. We'd do the dump once, of course, then we'd just copy it twice. Copy it once, you mean? No, twice, said Sarkar. You can't do an experiment without a control, you know that. Right, said Peter, slightly embarrassed. Anyway, we'd make one copy, which we would modify to simulate life after death. Call it the spirit simulacrum, and another to simulate immortality. And the third we would leave unmodified, said Sarkar. A baseline or control version that we can compare to the original living person to make sure that the simulacra retain their accuracy as time goes on.
Perfect, said Peter.
But you know, Peter, this wouldn't necessarily simulate true life after death. It's life outside the physical body. But who knows if the soul wave carries with it any of our memories? Of course, if it doesn't, then it's not really a meaningful continuation of existence. Without our memories, our pasts, what we were, it wouldn't be anything we'd recognize as a continuation of the same person.
I know, said Peter. But if the soul is anything like what people believe it to be, just the mind without the body, then this simulation at least would give us some idea of what that kind of soul would be like. Then I could have something intelligent to say the next time I get asked that what's life after death really like question.
Sarkar nodded. But why the research into immortality?
I went to one of those Life Unlimited seminars a while ago.
Really? Peter, surely you don't want that.
I don't know. It's fascinating in a way.
It's stupid.
Maybe, but it seems we could kill two birds with one stone with this research.
Perhaps, said Sarkar. But who would we simulate?
How about you? Asked Peter.
Sarkar raised a hand. No, not me. Last thing I want to do is live forever. True joy is possible only after death. I look forward to the felicity to be given to my realized soul in the next world. No, they were your questions, Peter. Why not use you?
Peter stroked his chin.
All right. If you're willing to undertake the project, I'm willing both to fund it and to be the guinea pig. He paused. This could answer some really big questions, Sarkar. After all, we know now that both physical immortality is possible and that some form of life after death exists. It would be a shame to choose one if the other turned out to be better.
Hobson's choice, said Sarkar.
Eh? Surely you know the phrase, your last name is Hobson after all.
I've heard the expression once or twice.
It refers to Thomas Hobson, a liveryman in England in, the 17th century, I think. He rented out horses, but required his customers to take either the horse nearest the stable door or none at all. Hobson's choice is a choice that offers no real alternative.
So
you don't get an alternative? Do you seriously think that if you were to bankrupt yourself buying nanotechnology immortality, that Allah couldn't take you anyway if he wanted to? You have a destiny, as do I. We have no choice. When it's time for you to go to the stable, the horse nearest the door will be the one that is meant for you. Call it Hobson's choice, or Qadr Allah, or Kismet, whatever term you use, it's the foredestiny of God.
Peter shook his head.
He and Sarkar rarely talked about religion, and he was beginning to remember why.
Are you willing to undertake the project?
Sure. My part is easy. You're the one who is going to have to face himself. You will see your own personality, the inner workings of your own mind, the interconnections that drive your thoughts. Do you really choose to do that?
Peter reflected for a moment.
Yes, he said.
I really do choose that. Sarkar smiled. Hobson's choice, he said, and signaled the server to bring the check. Net News Digest. The Archdiocese of Houston, Texas, would like to remind everyone that this coming Wednesday, November the 2nd, is All Souls Day, the day on which prayers are offered for souls in purgatory. Because of the recent surge of interest in this topic, a special Mass will be held at the Astrodome Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. The front-page editorial in the November issue of Our Bodies, newsletter of the group Women in Control, headquartered in Manchester, England, denounces the discovery of so-called fetal soul waves as yet another attempt by men to impose control over women's bodies. Raymond Moody's Life After Life, first published in 1975, was reissued this week by Netbooks and immediately surged to number 2 on the New York Times Daily Bestsellers list in the category of Premium Download Nonfiction. In Spirited Trading, Hobson Monitoring Limited, TSEHML, closed today at 57 1/8, up 6 3/8 from the day before, on a volume of 35,100 shares. This represents a new 52-week high for the Toronto-based biomedical equipment maker. A demonstration was held today out front of the freestanding Morgenthaler Abortion Clinic in Toronto, Ontario, by the organization Defenders of the Unborn. Abortion prior to the arrival of the soul wave is still a sin in the eyes of God, said protester Antula Sotirios. For the first 9 weeks of pregnancy, the fetus is a temple, being prepared for the arrival of the divine spark. Chapter 17. Thursday evening at home, Peter had long ago programmed the household computer to scan the TV listings for topics or shows that would interest him. For 2 years, he'd had a standing order for the VCR to record the film The Night Stalker, a made-for-TV movie he'd first encountered as a teenager, but so far it hadn't come on. He also asked to be alerted whenever an Orson Welles film was on, whenever Ralph Nader or Stephen Jay Gould was going to be on any talk show, and for any episodes of Night Court in which Brent Spiner guest starred. Tonight, DBS Cairo was showing Welles in The Stranger in English with Arabic subtitles. Peter's VCR had a subtitle eraser. It scanned the parts of the image adjacent to the subtitles, as well as the frames before and after the subtitles appeared, and filled in an extrapolation of the picture that had been obscured by the text. Quite a find. Peter hadn't seen The Stranger for 20 years. His VCR hummed quietly, recording it. Maybe he'd watch it tomorrow, or Saturday. Maybe. Kathy, sitting across the room from him, cleared her throat, then said, "My co-workers have been asking about you, about us." Peter felt his shoulders tense. "Oh? You know, about why we haven't been at the Friday night gatherings?" "What have you told them?" "Nothing. I've made excuses." "Do you think they know about what happened?" She considered. "I don't know. I'd like to think they don't, but that asshole Hans has a mouth on him." She said nothing. "Have you heard anything? Snide comments, innuendos? Anything to make you think your co-workers know?" "No," said Kathy, "nothing." "Are you sure?" She sighed. "Believe me, I've been particularly sensitive to what they've been saying. If they are gossiping behind my back, I haven't picked up on it. No one has said a word to me. Really, I suspect they don't know." Peter shook his head. "I don't think I could take it if they knew. Facing them, I mean, it's—" He paused, trying to come up with the appropriate word. "Humiliating." She knew better than to reply. "Damn," said Peter. "I hate this. I really fucking hate this." Kathy nodded. "Still," said Peter, "I suppose if we're ever going to have a normal life again, we've got to start going out, seeing people. Danita thinks that would be wise, too." "Danita?" "My counselor." "Oh." She was quiet for a moment then. "Hans left town today. He's attending a conference. If we went out after work with my friends tomorrow, he wouldn't be there." Peter took a deep breath, exhaled it noisily. "You're sure he won't be there?" he said. She nodded. Peter was silent for a time, marshaling his thoughts. "All right," he said at last. "I'll give it a try, as long as we don't stay too long." He looked her in the eyes. "But you better be right about him not being there. His voice took on a tone Kathy had never heard before, a stone-cold bitterness. If I see him again, I'll kill him. Peter arrived at the Bent Bishop early so that he could be sure of the seat directly beside his wife. The crew from Dewap Advertising had found a long table in the middle of the room this time, so they were all in captain's chairs. Peter did indeed get to sit next to Kathy. Opposite him was the pseudo-intellectual. His book reader was loaded with Camus.
"Evening, Doc," said Pseudo. "You're certainly in the news a lot these days?"
Peter nodded. "Hello."
"Not used to seeing you here so early," Pseudo said.
Peter immediately realized his mistake. Everything should have been exactly as before. He should be doing nothing that would attract attention to him or Kathy.
"Ducking reporters," Peter said.
Pseudo nodded and lifted a glass of dark ale to his lips.
"You'll be glad to know Hans won't be here."
Peter felt his cheeks flush, but in the dim lighting of the pub it was probably invisible.
"What do you mean?"
Peter had intended the question to come out neutrally, but there had been an undeniable edge to it. Next to him, Kathy patted his knee under the table. Pseudo lifted his eyebrows.
"Nothing, Doc. It's just that he and you don't seem to always get along. He was ribbing you a fair bit last time."
"Oh." The server had appeared. "Orange juice," said Peter. The server turned to Kathy, her face a question.
"Mineral water," Kathy said, "with lime." "Nothing to drink today?" said Pseudo, as if the very concept was an affront to all things decent.
"I've got a headache," said Kathy. "Took some aspirin." There was no end to lies, thought Peter. She couldn't say I stopped drinking because last time I got drunk I let a co-worker fuck me. Peter felt his fists clenching beneath the table. Two more of Kathy's friends arrived, a man and a woman, both middle-aged, both slightly heavy. Kathy said hi to them.
"Light turnaround tonight," said the man. "Where's Hans?"
"Hans is in Beantown," said Pseudo. Peter thought he'd been waiting all day to get to say Beantown.
"At that interactive video conference?"
"Gee," said the woman, "it won't be the same without Hans."
"Hans," thought Peter, "Hans, Hans. Each uttering of his name was like a knife thrust. Haven't these people ever heard of pronouns?"
The server reappeared and put some reconstituted orange juice in front of Kathy, and a small bottle of Perrier and a glass with a bruised lime wedge pushed into its rim in front of Peter. All non-alcoholic drinks were the same to her, he guessed. Peter and Kathy exchanged drinks, and the server took the newcomer's orders.
"So, how are things with the two of you?"
asked the newly arrived man, waving a hand generally at Peter and Kathy. Kathy smiled.
"Fine."
Why is he asking that, Peter thought. What does he know?
"Fine," echoed Peter. "Just fine." "You've been all over the TV, Peter," said Pseudo. "Going anywhere else soon?"
"Well, I'm not going to fucking Beantown."
"No," said Peter. "Then, maybe.
We haven't made any plans," said Kathy smoothly.
"But Peter has an understanding boss."
A chuckle or two from those who knew that Peter was the boss at his company.
"I've got to see how my schedule is shaping up at work. We've got that big Tourism Ontario contract coming up."
The woman nodded sympathetically. Evidently, that particular job was the bane of her existence, too. The server appeared with more drinks. Simultaneously, Toby Bailey, another of Kathy's co-workers, arrived.
"Evening all," said Toby.
He indicated to the server that he'd have the same thing as Pseudo.
"Where's Hans?"
"Boston," said Peter, preempting another uttering of Beantown. Pseudo looked slightly disappointed.
"Did Donna Lee go with him?"
"Not as far as I know," said Pseudo.
"Well, some American cutie is going to get porked tonight,"
said Toby, as if this was the most natural thing in the world. People chuckled. Hans seemed to have almost as big a presence when he wasn't there as when he was. Peter excused himself to go to the washroom.
"Well," observed Pseudo as Peter departed, "I guess even the rich and famous have to take a leak now and then."
Peter bristled as he made his way to the stairwell and walked down to the little basement that contained the two restrooms and a couple of payphones. He didn't really have to go, but he needed a little peace and quiet, a little time to get his bearings. It was like they were all mocking him. It was like they all knew. Of course they knew. Peter had heard enough of Hans's bragging in the past. Christ, they all probably knew about every one of Hans's conquests. He leaned against a wall. A Molson's bimbo smiled at him from a poster. It had been a mistake coming here. But wait. If Kathy's co-workers knew, they'd probably known for months. It was ages since she and Hans had first done it. Peter tried to think back to the last time he'd been here and the time before that. Had there been any indication that they knew? Were they really behaving differently tonight? He couldn't tell. Everything seemed different now. Everything. He'd be humiliated if they knew, his private life invaded on public view. Humiliated, degraded. Christ, Hobson can't keep a woman, eh? God damn it. Life had been so simple before. This had been a mistake. He headed back to the table. He would endure it for another hour. He looked at his watch. Yes, 60 minutes. He could take that. Maybe. Peter and Kathy walked wordlessly up to the door of their house. Peter touched his thumb to the file scanner, and he heard the locking mechanism disengaging. He stepped through the door into the tile-covered entry area and paused to remove his outdoor shoes. 4½ pairs of Kathy's shoes were already lined up in front of the closet. "Do you have to do that?" said Peter, pointing at them. "I'm sorry," said Kathy. "I'd like to be able to come into my own home without tripping over your shoes all the time." "I'm sorry," she said again. "You've got a shoe rack in the bedroom." "I'll move them there," she said. Peter placed his shoes on the mat. "You don't see me piling up shoes out here." Kathy nodded. Peter walked into the living room. "Computer! Messages!" he called out. "None," said a synthesized voice. He walked over to the couch, scooped up the remote, and sat down. He turned on the TV and began flipping channels with the sound on mute. "The pseudo-intellectual was in fine form tonight," said Peter, sarcastically. "Jonas," said Kathy. "His name is Jonas. What the fuck do I care what his name is?" Kathy sighed and went to make herself some tea. Peter knew he was being mean. He didn't want to be this way. He had been hoping tonight would go well, had been hoping that they could get on with their lives, with things the way they had always been. But it wouldn't work. Tonight had proved that. He couldn't have anything to do with their co-workers ever again. Even without Hans there, the sight of those people reminded Peter of what she'd done, of what Hans had done. Peter could hear the sounds of a spoon hitting china in the kitchen as Kathy stirred milk into her tea. "Aren't you going to join me?" he called out. She appeared in the doorway that led to the kitchen, her face impassive. Peter put down the remote and looked at her. She was trying to be cooperative, trying to be brave. He didn't want to be mean to her. He just wanted what they had had before. "I'm sorry," Peter said. Kathy nodded, hurt, but stalwart. "I know." Chapter 18 Sarkar Muhammad's artificial intelligence company was called Mirror Image. Its offices were located in Concord, Ontario, north of Metro Toronto. Peter met Sarkar there on Saturday morning, and Sarkar took him upstairs to the newly created scanning room. It had originally been just a regular office. There were crushed indentations in the rug where filing cabinets had once been. There had also been a large window, but it had been completely covered with plywood panels to prevent light from coming in from outside, and the walls had been lined with gray foam rubber molded in egg carton shapes to deaden sound. In the center of the room was an old dentist's chair on a swivel base, and along one wall was a bench covered with a PC, various oscilloscopes, and several other pieces of equipment, including some circuitry breadboards lying out in the open. Sarkar motioned for Peter to sit in the dentist's chair. "Just a little off the top," said Peter. Sarkar smiled. "We are going to take everything off the top, get a complete record of everything in your brain." He positioned the scanner's skull cap on Peter's head. "L'chaim," said Peter. Sarkar loosely fastened the cap's chin strap and motioned for Peter.